Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting the film series Testigo Witness, Goya in the Movies. Held on select Fridays in May, each film touches upon artist Francisco de Goya's visions of the world, kicking off with Pan's Labyrinth by Guillermo del Toro on May 10th at NortonSimon.org.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle. On this Halloween weekend, it's time for horror. Our critics Claudia Puig and Amy Nicholson review scary movies from around the world. Our critic Tim Cogshell and Texas A&M professor Robin Means Coleman are also with us to talk about the history of black horror films. Professor Coleman's the author of Horror Noir, Blacks in American Horror Films from the 1890s to the Present. We've also got a very LA-centric documentary, The Donut King. It tells the story of Ted Noy, a Cambodian refugee to California who sparked the donut shop boom throughout our region. You're listening to Franz Waxman's score of The Bride of Frankenstein. It's Film Week right after NPR News. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us on this spooky Halloween weekend. And we've got several horror films this week to talk about with our critics. Amy Nicholson, film writer for the New York Times and host of the podcasts Unspooled and Zoom. And Claudia Puig, who's the president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association and the senior programmer of the AFI Film Festival here in Los Angeles. We begin with a horror film, appropriately, His House, which is a British-U.S. co-production. The film is directed by Remy Weeks. The film's co-written by Felicity Evans and Toby Venables. Sope DiRiso is the star of the film. Claudia, what'd you think of His House?
I like this film quite a lot. The initial escape is harrowing when you watch them escaping from South Sudan, and then probably even more harrowing in some ways, or harrowing in completely, you know, sort of more quotidian ways, is their adjustment to their new life in this English town. There's this evil lurking under the surface, and it's kind of a, you know, it has the classic haunted house elements, but it's much deeper, and it's also about people facing their trauma, their history of trauma, you know, from a war-torn country, and bringing that with them. It's allegorical. It's also about, you know, sort of the cluelessness of the people around them who don't understand what it's like to be a refugee in a new place. And each of the two lead characters who are wonderful react in different ways. Wunmi Mosaku and Sope DiRiso are really wonderful in this film. It's haunting, but deeper than just a haunted, you know, than a scary story.
His House, and we've had so many topical horror films in recent years. Amy, what did you think of His House?
Oh, I think this film is an absolute knockout. I mean, when we're looking to the horror genre to tell us stories that have such emotional resonance, and in this case, you know, a really strong, beautiful political undercurrent about adapting to a new life in England, what do you leave behind when you've come from a place of violence? You know, this film does it just fantastically, because not only are all the themes there and the ideas and the messages and the history, but there's just terrific performances. The cinematography is amazing. Like, step by step, I really adored this film. And there's some lines in here that just really hit home. You know, this is kind of a spooky ghost story where they're stuck in this estate housing where they have a bunch of rules. They can't leave. You're really literally trapped there and surrounded already by horrible little things, you know, roaches, mean neighbors. And yet the wife in this, who gives such a powerful performance, she has this line where she says, "After all that we have seen, you know, after all we've seen that men can do, do you think I'm still afraid of bumps in the night?" And that's the kind of line that gives me really shivers. I can't speak highly enough of this film.
Now, it's unrated. Claudia, what age range do you think it's appropriate for?
I'm not sure that young kids would get as much out of it because of the political, you know, resonance that this has. So I'm guessing you know, teens, maybe 13 or 14 on up. It is, you know, there's some creepy stuff, but it is, as Amy pointed out, just a much deeper story about what goes on for refugees and sort of the political adjustment and or the adjustment to, you know, this small town that doesn't understand what these people are going through, and then their own personal demons and nightmares. So it's, I would say, yeah, 13 or 14 and up.
And Amy, are there supernatural elements to the horror here or not?
Yeah, there definitely are. There definitely are. The villain, well, I'll put a few air quotes around that in the film, is
without giving away. I don't want to give away the, you know, the scares. But.
Well, I'll just say that they attribute it to a night witch from the South Sudan called an Apeth, and the Apeth can take on forms, but it really takes on the form of the guilt and trauma that's on their mind, which turns out to have a few more twists and turns to it than I was even expecting. Wow. It's yeah, really smartly done.
It does.
It has these great twists and turns.
Oh, I'm sorry. It has great twists and turns. Boy, that's a hard one to say quickly. and yes, this shape-shifting sort of spirited thing, in addition to the rats and other things that are also more realistic scares.
And Remy Weeks, he's a first-time director, so it's impressive to make a film that you're so high on.
Yeah, indeed. Very much, very much. This is the kind of debut where you're like, oh, you don't just have a message to say, you know, you're not just like making a low-budget horror film as a way of saying like, pay attention to me. Like, you actually have real competence and skill. Like, it feels like you're in the hands of a real director who's made artistic choices to go along with the narrative ones.
We're talking about the horror film His House, a British-US co-production. The film is streaming on Netflix, and it's unrated. The Spanish-French mystery Madre is directed by Rodrigo Sorogoyen, who co-wrote the screenplay with Isabel Peña. Claudia, what'd you think of Madre?
I really like this film. I remember the short from 2017. I don't know if you remember this, but it was Oscar nominated, and it was one of the most kind of haunting shorts. It was all one long take. It was 17 minutes about a mother who was on the phone with her six-year-old son who had gone with his dad to a beach, and suddenly he was left alone. And so she's trying to talk him through, you know, what's going on? Where are you? He doesn't know. He's six. And so this is this harrowing short. And then this incorporates that for the beginning of the film. And then it picks up 10 years later. So what, you know, was really urgent, intense, and propulsive in that short becomes, it was like a thriller. It becomes more of a psychological drama, even a meditation on adjusting to, I will just say 10 years later, and she's living a different life. She's not in Madrid anymore. She's near Biarritz on the coast, where her son had called her from. And I don't want to give too much away because I think, you know, it's something that really needs to be absorbed. But it's slower, more deliberately paced, and probably no less unsettling. In many ways, just as unsettling, but it looks at how someone emotionally adjusts to loss. And Martha Nieto in the title role is fantastic. The nuances of her performance are just breathtaking. It's a really, really wonderful film.
We're talking about the film from director and co-screenwriter Rodrigo Sorogoyen, Madre. Amy.
Yeah, I adored this film too. I mean, to open with that really harrowing single shot phone call and then make a film that actually is just as tense and nail biting in so many smaller little ways. I mean, Marta Nieto, the actress, she's incredibly beautiful, which is the thing that factors in, because I'll give away just a tiny bit more than Claudia, but I'm still in the first act. Okay. I swear. I'm not giving away anything too major. But she, living in her new life, she's relocated to where she thinks her son might have been. She hasn't found him, but she sees a teenager who's about his age. And the teenager thinks she's following him because she has a crush on him. And so the teenager starts to get the wrong impression, and their relationship, you know, two people who are drawn to each other for completely different reasons, both reasons being pretty bad and both reasons headed towards disaster. It's really fantastically done, you know, and I appreciate that the child who plays the actor in here, the teenager, he's not like a quote unquote perfect kid. He's kind of a jerk, you know, and she becomes kind of a jerk. There's so many interesting levels in this film.
I love that he incorporated the short into the film, because often the shorts are calling cards, but aren't necessarily built on the foundation of the short. And Claudia, I can't off the top of my head think of when that's happened before.
I can't off the top of my head either. And what I loved about this was when I saw the short, I wanted to know what happened. I wanted it to continue. And yet the way in which it continues is not at all what I would have envisioned. And that's very much to its credit. You know, I wanted a very simple, like, what happened? And this is, it does sort of answer that to some degree, but not in the way you would expect it to answer it. So nothing about this is predictable, which is a really wonderful thing. Even the relationship between Martha's character and this boy is deliberately ambiguous. You're just intrigued throughout. And it's just, yeah, it's fascinating. And also really made me want to go to this particular part of the French beach area. It's near Biarritz, I guess, but not in Biarritz proper. It made me like immediately go. I think it's that desire to be traveling.
Yeah, once post-COVID. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
By the way, the young man who plays the teenager in the film is Jules Poirier. The film is Madre, from director and co-screenwriter Rodrigo Sorohoyan. Stars Martha Nieto. The film's unrated. You can see it on Lemley's Virtual Cinema, as well as multiple video on demand platforms. The documentary The Donut King tells the wild story of the ups and downs of a Cambodian refugee who arrived in the U.S. in the mid-1970s to not only build a multimillion dollar empire for himself, but for others in the same industry. The film is The Donut King. Alice Gu, the director. Amy?
Oh, this documentary is so fun. I had such a kick with this. You know, it's the sort of documentary that is a very local LA story. You know, you're learning like why we have so many donut shops here, more per capita than anywhere else in America. You're learning why 90% of them are Cambodian owned. And yet, as you trace this story, you know, through the eyes of this one man, Ted Noy, it becomes just this global story about immigration, about ambition, about hope, about community. And it's got a really terrific soundtrack. I'm impressed that the documentarian here was able to get Wu-Tang to give her permission to play the song Cream, which is, you know, a song about making money, but it also is very much a song that sounds like it could be about donuts. And I enjoyed so much of this doc.
We're talking about The Donut King. Claudia.
Yes, I feel the same way. It's not only is it a fascinating portrait of this particular Cambodian refugee, Ted Noy, but it also is, you know, it's about the culture of donut shops in LA, which are so iconic, and it's a fascinating part of LA history. And it also looks at Cambodia and what was going on with Khmer Rouge, which is also very interesting. It won, or Alice Gu, the director, won at South by Southwest special jury recognition, rightly so. And it's a fascinating story of the rise and fall of this particular immigrant and how he helped, you know, so many others to get their own donut shops. And I guess, and also just kept these giant corporations like, you know, Dunkin' Donuts and Winchell's at bay. So all of that is fascinating, but it's also about his own sort of, voracious greed for, and eventually he becomes a gambler. So it's the rise and fall.
I knew his story, Claudia, and I was wondering, how long is it going to take for someone to make a documentary about him? Because update I'd see was about another, you know, rise or fall. His life was so operatic. It's such an amazing story. I'm glad that the story is told in a documentary, because I've kind of been waiting for this. So it's good to hear.
Oh, that's so great. Yeah. Just the things like, you know, he's the one, those beautiful pink boxes that we see and we all start salivating when we see those pink boxes. He's the one who came up with that idea because it was cheaper than the other boxes. And then the way he, you know, found that he was determined to marry his wife, who was the daughter of this wealthy, influential family. And he just, you know, that story is amazing. It is so operatic. It's fascinating.
The Donut King, the documentary from director Alice Gu, and it's at the Santa Ana Regency Theaters, also Lemley's Virtual Cinema, and it's on demand on Google Play. Also, our own Elena Shatkin of LAist.com has a profile of Ted Noy that is on LAist.com. You can read Elena's piece there at LAist.com. We have a link as well on our Film Week page at kpecc.org. The Donut King is unrated. We have just about a minute to get started, at least, on the documentary Us Kids, which profiles students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida who speak about their experiences after 17 people were killed in gun violence at their school. Claudia?
I really like this documentary. I saw it at Sundance. It asks very difficult questions about what it means to grow up in a country where gun violence is so common, where, you know, you fear you can go, going to school is fraught. And of course, we know these kids, David Hogg, Emma Gonzalez, are very familiar. There's a few others that are a little bit less familiar that are profiled. And we'll get into more of it, I guess.
Yeah, you got it. Us Kids is the documentary we're talking about from director Kim A. Snyder. Also, we have more horror films to talk about on this Halloween weekend, including From India Come Play. And we'll talk about another horror film, Kali Kuhi, that an Indian horror film. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. If you listen by podcast, we just remind you, you can listen to Film Week whenever you want by hearing the podcast, your favorite place to get podcasts. Coming up later this hour, we're going to be talking about black horror films, a large number of films and high-quality films made by African-Americans, in some cases that are specifically aimed at black moviegoers, but in other cases not, but with a decidedly black perspective. We'll talk about those films coming up later this hour. Right now, I'm talking with critics Amy Nicholson and Claudia Puig joining us for this week's movies, including the documentary Us Kids, which profiles the students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida, speaking about gun violence after the terrible event that happened 2 years ago at their school. Kim A. Snyder, the director. Claudia?
Yeah, what this does is it offers real sort of testimony to the power of citizen protest. And, you know, we get the sense these kids are so brave. They're not just brave that obviously they survived this horrific incident that no one should have to go through, but then they revisit it every day as they're going through this process of, you know, kind of taking on politicians and the NRA. And we do also see them in lighter moments, and we realize that, you know, Emma Gonzalez can be kind of goofy. And also, wisely, the film pivots and connects the Parkland students' stories to those of black students who have a very different experience with gun violence, a daily experience that doesn't get the same kind of national spotlight. It was just very well done. And it, of course, it highlights their resilience and their bravery. And it may be something that we feel like in the midst of a pandemic, we don't want to necessarily see, but we should. And it's a movie that, you know, needs to be seen.
Us Kids is unrated, and you can see it on the Alamo Drafthouse On Demand site. Come Play, a horror thriller written and directed by Jacob Chase. Amy?
Yeah, this is a Babadook knockoff, to be honest. This is a Babadook knockoff for parents who are worried that their kids are spending way too much time staring at screens. Because what's happening here is you have a child with autism and he's unable to speak, but his parents have figured out a way for him to communicate. He has an iPad with buttons that do talking for him. And it helps him try to navigate the bullies at school until one day there's a monster in the iPad that's really lonely, and it can also go to other cell phones, and it can move around, and it just wants him to come play with him and live with him forever. And I have to admit, this monster is pretty boring. It just spends the whole movie turning light bulbs on and off. Like, the whole movie is just like lights go on and light bulbs go off. It happens like 6 times. It's just light bulbs.
It keeps the budget down, doesn't it?
It does. Sometimes it plays with Instagram filters. I have to say the best thing about the monster, though, is its name is Larry. And so the entire time I was watching this movie, I was like, Larry's trying to get me.
See, I'm offended he's such a dull monster.
You come through our ears on the radio, and now you're trying to get me through the phone.
That's funny. Come Play is the horror film. Azee Robertson stars along with Gillian Jacobs, Jacob Chase, the writer, director. It's rated PG-13 at Riverside's Van Buren Drive-In and select Orange County theaters. Kali Kuhi, an Indian horror mystery, is directed by Terry Samundra, who co-wrote the screenplay with David Walter Lech. Claudia?
I like this film. It's kind of focused around a 10-year-old girl, Shivangi, who's essentially has to save her family's village in Punjab from these ghosts of the past. And it's beautifully shot. It has a real organic sense of suspense. It's ominous and mysterious. There's just a sense of dread that's palpable throughout. The child actors are good. The village is very vividly rendered to the point where you could see flies on people, which of course made me go to the Pence thing. But anyway, it felt very immersive in this world. And it's well done. It's quite, there's some special effects at the end that look a little bit schlocky and slightly gross. But other than that, I thought it worked pretty well.
Amy, what do you think of Kali Kuhi?
You know, I wanted to like this film a little more because I haven't seen that many horror films coming out of India. And this one is one that, kind of like His House that we were talking about earlier, is really trying to have this big resonance, you know, a political story, because it's about, you know, female infanticide in India and the ghosts of these girls who have been, you know, in this story, thrown into a well. And the pressure of the community to do that over generations, the old women and the grandmothers who, you know, they've suffered and they feel like other people need to suffer, or at least respect their suffering or be told, and the kind of cultural shaming that's happening here. It's a really smart underpinning of a story. And I was kind of sad that when it got to the actual scares for me, they're a little bit generic. You know, it's a lot of just like creep, creep, creep. Oh no, creep, creep, creep. Oh dear. And I wish this just took one more step to be great, but it does manage to have what I found to be a pretty emotional ending, you know, especially an emotional final shot.
Kali Kuhi, the film from India, is unrated and it's streaming on Netflix. The True Adventures of Wolf Boy, a drama that stars Jaden Martell. It's directed by Martin Krejci and written by Olivia Dufaux. Amy?
This film surprised me. You know, it seems very twee. It's about a little boy. He's a preteen. He's covered in hair all over his face. He looks like the Wolf Man. And his father, played by Chris Messina, is like, you gotta learn to love yourself. And he doesn't buy it. And the film doesn't really take that answer as an easy answer. You know, it's about what this kid does when he winds up running away from his dad and being on the road and forming friendships with other misfits. He meets up fairly quickly with a young trans girl who's having problems with her mom. They go on the run. And at every moment, I was holding my breath, waiting for this film to just become absolute treacle, just like cotton candy, you know, being like, everything's fine, love yourself. And to the credit of the director, Martin Krejci, and the writer, Olivia Dufaux, they take some tough choices. You know, they don't sugarcoat everything. They have the kids do some bad stuff. There's a part where they start robbing convenience stores for candy, and it's not done completely cutesy. So I appreciate that at every moment where I expected this to become an easy kiddie cliche, it was a little darker. It had a bit of that 80s Disney feel that I respect. I respected this film much more than I expected to.
The True Adventures of Wolf Boy, by the way, is rated PG-13. Claudia?
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised in a very similar way. Also, there's a real standout performance by the young trans girl, Sophie Janamore, I think it's pronounced. She was great. She really sort of, you have John Turturro in it also, in this sort of fun performance as this malevolent owner of a carnival, kind of a circus carnival, that he wants to make him into, you know, a circus freak kind of show thing. And so he's kind of there as a villain in the background. Not, you know, he's always fun to see. And he's got a whole different hair, gray hair and a ponytail. It's not the usual John Turturro. So that was kind of fun. But yeah, I appreciated that it didn't have easy answers. I appreciated he has a reunion with his mother who hasn't been in his life. And it isn't, you know, all, you know, kisses and hugs and everything's fine. It's still fraught. I like, you know, the whole idea of kind of dealing with the misfits. And I think that, you know, I believe that the writer is trans as well. So she's, you know, I think the story is an LGBTQ story that is worth telling and well told.
The True Adventures of Wolf Boy, directed by Martin Krejci, Jaden Martell, and Chris Messina stars, rated PG-13 and available on pretty much all video on demand platforms. Radium Girls, set in the 1920s with factory workers advocating for safer conditions. It stars Joey King, Abby Quinn, and Kara Seymour. Lydia Dean Pilcher and Ginny Moeller are the co-directors. Moeller co-wrote the film with Brittany Shaw. Radium Girls, Amy?
Yeah, this is a story, basically this activism for teenage girls. Like, it's pretty easy for me to watch this film and roll my eyes at it. But, you know, I would give this film to the young girls in my life because it is based on the true story of a group of factory workers whose job was painting numbers on watch dials with radioactive paint so that they'd glow in the dark. And it's very hard for me to wrap my head around this, but in the 1920s, radium was just considered fine. You know, there was a sister film, Marie Curie's A Radioactive, that came out this year that also got into this. But people were drinking it in water. They were painting it on their faces. They thought it was healthy. And so this stars Joey King, a young actress who I've always thought has a ton of integrity, you know, playing a girl who reluctantly becomes political when she loses first one sister and then possibly another to radium poisoning. And so I appreciate that. You know, there's a lot of kind of, oh, all right. You've got to get in the references to Sacco and Vanzetti. You've got to get in a reference to the Tulsa race riots. There's a lot of setting the tone and letting you know everything else that's happening. It can feel kind of like a kid's book. But it's hard to hate this movie because I respect at least what it's trying to do.
Radium Girls, Claudia.
Yeah, I respect it as well. And it's an inherently intriguing story. There were three different factories in the U.S. where, you know, radium was being used to paint these watch dials. One was in New Jersey, one was in Connecticut, one was in Illinois. This one focuses on the one in New Jersey, and it takes this court case and it kind of, I think the characters are an amalgamation of the real life characters. It made me want to see a documentary about this because I felt like while this was very well-meaning and intrinsically interesting, I found the performances a bit pallid and, it's an inspiring story, but you know, some of that interstitial archival footage I didn't feel was necessary, felt like padding. So, you know, it's certainly entertaining enough, but I would rather have seen it in a more serious way.
Radium Girls is unrated. It's on Lemley's Virtual Cinema and Google Play on Demand. And finally, this week, Spell, a horror film starring Omari Hardwick, Loretta Devine, and John Beasley. Mark Tondere, the director, Kurt Wimmer, the screenwriter. Amy, just briefly on Spell, please.
Yeah, Spell has such a strong beginning and then winds up being a bit of a disappointment. But it's about a rich lawyer who flies back, he owns his own plane, to rural Appalachia where he's from. And his plane crashes and he wakes up in the house of Loretta Devine, who's sort of this voodoo priestess of his old hometown. And he's trapped literally back in the place where he never wanted to be. It's kind of like Misery with voodoo, with, you know, shock therapy. I guess, and I wish this was more fun. It has a couple great ideas, but it just drags them out and doesn't move with the pace I really wish it had at the beginning.
Claudia, what do you think of Spell?
Very similar. I was interested that it was shot in South Africa by a British Zimbabwean director because it was supposed to be Kentucky and Appalachia. I really wish it had been more commentary on class and sort of city versus rural folks and maybe less of the grisly gore that didn't seem to really achieve much purpose.
Spell is at the Mission Tiki Drive-In in Montclair and available on multiple on-demand platforms. It's rated R. Well, the AFI Fest has just concluded its run, and our Claudia Puig is the senior programmer for the AFI Film Festival. And I know you did it as an online festival this year. How did that work out, Claudia?
You know, it was very interesting. So it's the first time, of course, in its 34-year history that it was virtual. But the upside of it is that we could have attendees from everywhere. So all 50 states were represented in terms of attendance. And our attendance doubled from the attendance last year because it was virtual. Yeah. And you could have greater involvement from the filmmakers. So we had 100% involvement in terms of Q&As and panels and all of that. So those are the big advantages to the virtual fest. I'm sorry, you were about to ask.
I was just gonna ask about the winners for narrative feature Wolf Walkers, which that's from the Secret of Kells animators.
Yes, yes,
whose work
indeed.
We love.
Yes, yes, that was the one of the audience winners, and rightly so. Their work is beautiful. And let's see, we had the documentary winner was 76 Days, which is very timely because it's about, it's set in Wuhan, it's about lockdown during COVID-19. So those were the big winners from the audience. We had some really great films. We had tributes to Mira Nair and Rita Moreno, Kirby Dick, and Sofia Coppola. We had some fantastic films. We had a drive-in movie. That was my first attendance at a drive-in, One Night in Miami at the Rose Bowl, and that went really well. I love that clapping is horn honking now at the end of a movie. It went surprisingly smoothly. 53% of the movies are directed by women, 39% by people of color, and there were 55 features from like 30 some countries. So it was and a lot of great panels with people like Ava DuVernay and you know, the filmmakers themselves, Errol Morris with the Reagans. And it was great.
That's terrific. I can't imagine the number of hours you put in to determine which films would be part of AFI Fest. But Claudia, thanks so much. Amy Nicholson, Claudia Puig with us on Film Week. Coming up, our Film Week critic Tim Cox will be with me. We're going to talk about the tremendous increase in the number of horror films that have been written and directed by African-American creative teams. That coming up. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. That's Blackula Strikes from the original motion picture soundtrack of the 1972 film. It was about 15 years ago, we were doing an AirTalk remote broadcast from Leimert Park, right in Leimert Village, a center of historic African-American Los Angeles. And one of the attendees came up to me after the event and said, I'm a big Film Week listener and I'm a film director. And I said, oh, what have you directed? He said, oh, I'm sure you haven't heard of it. He said, Blackula. I having seen Blackula probably four times, I said, Blackula, you directed. Well, it was like working with William Marshall. And anyway, we talked for 45 minutes about Blackula. But let's hear a scene from the film. Again, William Crane, the director of the 1972 blaxploitation film Blackula. In this scene from the beginning of the film, Dracula, played by Charles McCauley, curses Mama Walde, played by William Marshall, an ancient African prince to an eternal thirst for blood.
I shall place a curse of suffering on you that will doom you to a living hell. A hunger, a wild, gnawing, animal hunger will grow in you. A hunger for human blood. Here you will starve for an eternity, torn by an unquenchable lust. You with my name, you shall be Blackula.
Some actors with tremendous voices in that film. And in this portion of Film Week, our focus are on horror films of African-American characters, storylines, writers, and directors. And we're very pleased to have with us from Texas A&M University, Professor of Communication, Robin Means Coleman, Vice President and Associate Provost for Diversity at Texas A&M as well. She's author of the book Horror Noir, Blacks in American Horror Films from 1890s to the Present. Her book was the basis for last year's documentary, Horror Noir, A History of Black Horror. Professor Coleman, thank you very much for being with us today on Film Week.
I'm so excited to be here, and I love that you started with William Crane's movie, Blackula.
Oh, and just the extraordinary dignity and torment that William Marshall brought to that character of Blackula. I know your research, your book goes well back to the very end of the 19th century, but how important were in that, what we call the Blaxploitation era, the 1970s, those films that had horror themes?
Oh, enormously important. And I really do think that Blackula is a great place to start this conversation. What William Marshall and William Crane did together, what they created, is certainly far from Black exploitation. It's regrettable that it gets lumped in with that moniker. Certainly, there are other films that felt exploitive during that time, films like Blackenstein or Dr. Black and Mr. Hyde, those kinds of lower budget films. But what William Crane does is a really thoughtful piece that's almost pedagogical about Black life and culture, the ways in which the slave trade is still apparent in contemporary times. And then it also gives us a really good peek inside of the Black lives of folks in LA and particularly around the Watts area. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's as instructive as it is entertaining.
Yeah, I love it because it does give you that real sense of place. There's no question about it. We're talking with professor at Texas A&M University, Robin Means Coleman. She's author of Horror Noir. Also with us, our Film Week critic, Tim Cogshell, whose reviews you can also read at Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com. Tim, you're a huge fan of horror films. And I was just wondering, when you were a kid growing up, was there a particular film for you that just really let you know you loved the genre?
Well, I know that I saw Blackula at the drive-in back in St. Louis, the Thunderbird drive-in, which was a drive-in sort of populated in the urban community where I lived. And all of the Black folks went to that drive-in. And Blackula was the place that I saw that. Now, so that one lives large in my mind. There were sequels. It was Scream, Black, Yellow, Scream, and all of that kind of stuff. William happens to have made that other movie that we were talking about. Sometimes it's called Watts Monster. Sometimes it's called, you know, Dr. Black and Mr. Hyde. Sometimes it's like Bernie Casey film. But even that film, that 1976 film, which I also remember seeing at the drive-in, Bernie Casey is this doctor who is trying to develop a cure for something and accidentally turns himself into an albino vampire. So I think that there was a measure of commentary,
yeah,
even in those films that sort of worked their way down the food chain a little bit. But yeah, all of those movies were fixtures when I was sort of growing
up.
Well,
and was one of the themes colorism in that, or what was that script getting at?
Well, yeah, to a certain extent, it was certainly getting at colorism and some of the ways that we treat each other in the Black community. But also, it was pointed, about the sort of racial identity thing that was going 1976. That was still going on in society even then.
Tim Cogshell with us. And of course, we're going to talk about what we've seen, the tremendous increase in the number of horror films written, directed by, starring African-Americans, also with social themes, African-American perspectives that are woven in. And in fact, let's, you know, give an example of something very current. This Jordan Peele, his 2017 film, Get Out, which I love because it so perfectly walks that tightrope of horror and dark comedy. In this scene, Chris Washington, played by Daniel Kaluuya, realizes his new girlfriend's family have spent years harvesting the brains of Black people and implanting them in the bodies of white folks. He tries to leave.
What is your purpose, Chris?
What?
In life, what is your purpose?
Right now, it's finding those keys. Yeah.
Huh. Fire. It's a reflection of our own mortality. We're born, we breathe, and we die.
Rose?
I'm lucky.
Even the sun will die someday. But we are divine. We are the gods trapped in cocoons.
Rose.
I don't know where they are.
Rose?
girls! Throw to your teeth!
Bradley Whitford with such a great performance in Jordan Peele's Get Out. Professor Coleman, the film to me seems, aside from the fact it's an African-American who wrote it and directed it, and that there are social themes in it, just a tremendous accomplishment as a suspense film with comedic elements.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And I think that's an important point. Just as where we started with Dr. Black and Mr. Hyde and getting all the way to Get Out, Black horror need not be, to be legitimate, super cerebral. In fact, that's kind of antithetical to the horror genre in itself. It doesn't have to always be pedagogical or a social syllabus about life and culture, but it is often steeped with both comedic elements. There are certainly historical reflections in these movies, but Get Out is, I would say, one of the few films that made America fall in love with the TSA for a brief moment.
We'll continue our conversation on Film Week. Larry Mantle joined by our critic Tim Cogshell and by Professor Robin Means Coleman of Texas A&M University, where she's also vice president and associate provost. Her book, Horror Noir, Blacks in American Horror Films, from the 1890s to the present. We're going to go back and talk about some of those early films with African-American performers and African-American creative teams behind them. It's Halloween weekend, of course, and we're talking about Black horror on Film Week. We'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to the main title theme from Get Out, Jordan Peele's 2017 film, which won him the Oscar for Best Director and nominations for Best Picture and Best Original Screenplay. We're talking about Black horror films and all the new productions that we're having, but also the history of it as well. Talking with Texas A&M University Provost and Professor Robin Means Coleman, who's author of Horror Noir, Blacks in American Horror Films from the 1890s to the present, and our Film Week critic Tim Cogshell. Professor Coleman, take us back to the early creative work by African Americans and the depictions of African Americans in horror. What were those images like?
I appreciate the question because it speaks to a sort of contrast that I've worked to set up both in the book and the movie, which is there are two types of horror films that feature Black folks. There are those films that are Blacks in horror, which really don't come out of the imagination of Black directors, but come out of white filmmakers' imaginations and white studios. And then there's Black horror films, which do come out of the imagination, the creative juices, if you will, of Black image makers. And so one of the things that's helpful to do is to kind of compare those two and in some cases not conflate them. So early films would be, you know, I go back to even the 1800s, but in casting films like Birth of a Nation, which we often don't think of as a horror film, but I write it as such. And so moving forward from that, there are all sorts of movies. Chloe, Love is Calling You, which is a 30s movie that some people may or may not remember. Monsters Walk, 1932, King of Zombies, 1941. Where you have Black actors who are in these films, but they're not really telling Black stories. That's a contrast with the films that we've just been talking about, Blackula, Get Out, and of course, you know, thinking ahead to other, for example, Jordan Peele movies like Us. So I think that there's a interesting trajectory where Blacks are included, sometimes stereotypically, sometimes in token roles, certainly lends credence to the notion the Black guy dies first, to where we are today with the kinds of film offerings by Jordan Peele or Nia DaCosta.
I used to go to, when I was a kid, to the World Theater on Hollywood Boulevard, where you could see three films for a buck. And they'd show a lot of horror films there, and it would be often very heavily African-American audience. And one of the things that was really fun about those movies is so much talking back to the screen that went on, you know, during the watching of those films, many of them low-budget horror films. Does that play into, Professor Coleman, any of the creative process, knowing that in some African-American theaters it is participatory?
Ah, so you're talking about call and response.
Exactly,
in,
yes.
In response to a range of entertainment forms, you know, concerts and music, and but also within, you know, the cultural ethos, for example, in the church. So does that play into a director's creative process? So I've never asked that question of an image maker, but I certainly know how much an audience gives back to a film is sort of in, on their minds, right? That is part of the audience experience, not just what's on the big screen, but what's happening in the auditorium amongst viewers.
Yeah. And Tim, I don't know if you had that experience growing up in St. Louis, where it's that sort of participatory movie viewing. But, you know, for certain films, it adds so much.
Oh, it was the only way to go to the movies. And it didn't really make any difference whether or not it was a horror movie. It could be a drama, a romance. When, girl, don't go in there. You all of that kind of stuff. And I know that these things sort of like sometimes play out as stereotypes. But, you know, in the context of the community where I grew up, it was true. And I rather enjoyed it and loved it. And it made it a lot of fun, particularly, you know, going to actual sit-in theaters when we could back then. And then there was a sort of sophisticated cinema as well. You know, as I was still a kid, but I remember that my older uncles would take me to see movies like Ganja and Hess, 1973 movie. And this was like extremely sophisticated filmmaking, Bill Gunn film. Dwayne Jones happened to be the lead in that movie. And of course, Dwayne had been the lead in Night of the Living Dead, the 1968 George Romero film. And this was a film like nothing I'd ever seen before. You know, when he tells me he's taking me to this horror film, and it's a vampire movie, but it's based on African lore, and it has nothing whatsoever to do with white people.
Professor Coleman, let's talk about the portrayals of African-American film, because Night of the Living Dead, of course, has a very brave and you know, central African-American character in that film. And when did that start changing to where African-Americans were fully realized characters in horror?
So I would go back much earlier than 1968, Night of the Living Dead, with Dwayne Jones's portrayal of Ben. Certainly Ben is probably one of the most classic. I just love Ben. And when people say, what's your favorite horror movie? I point to Night of the Living Dead. But if I was to be honest, I point to that moment when Ben takes charge in the cabin. It is hardly for me a zombie movie, but it is all about perhaps even revealing my crush on this character that is Ben. But characters like Ben are showing up throughout horror history, and in some cases, decades earlier. And they appear in films that are offered up by Spencer Williams, Oscar Michaud, Eloise Gist. So there are Black horror makers who are making Black horror films in the 30s and in the 40s. Spencer Williams' The Blood of Jesus is an example of that, where you see these whole and full realized, fully fleshed out Black characters.
We're talking with Texas A&M University professor Robin Means Coleman, author of Horror Noir, Blacks in American Horror Films from the 1890s to Present. And her book was the basis for last year's documentary, Horror Noir, A History of Black Horror. Professor Coleman, what are some of your favorites of very recent and current African-American themed or created horror?
So there are categories to this, and I can't wait to hear what Tim might say about this. But Jay Dilla's film Sweetheart has one of the best monster reveals that I have ever seen. It is absolutely a must-see. There are a few classic films that get to me. I never miss an opportunity to watch John Carpenter's The Thing. The film I'm probably most looking forward to is Candyman. I just cannot wait.
That 1992 film being remade. Tim, what's your favorite of recent and current stuff?
Atlantics is this wonderful Matty Diop film. She's a black Senegalese director, but she's French. And she makes this wonderful, wonderful film set in Senegal that's so moody and so creepy and so scary. It's about these men who come back to invade the bodies of their girlfriends, and then their girlfriends go out and get their money. Creepy, creepy film. Excellent mood.
All right. And of course, we've got Lovecraft Country and new series and all kinds of terrific creative output from African-American writer, directors, on-screen talent as well. My thanks to our Film Week critic, Tim Cogshell, and Texas A&M professor, Robin Means Coleman. Thanks for joining us on Film Week.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.